Today we're wrapping up our revolutionary series, and love the title. It doesn't mean that everything we said was revolutionary, but we're talking about the revolutionary love of Jesus. And so I guess if we don't call every series revolutionary after this, it's unrevolutionary. I'm just kidding. I've really enjoyed the content, and I hope that you have too, as it's given us the opportunity to think differently about Christianity and the Christian life. And if you missed any of the previous weeks, you can listen on our website. There are also some, I think, some really helpful follow-up questions that may help you and others engage in conversation around the topics a little bit more. And I know that this topic is a little polarizing, and some of you have really got into it. You really digged it. Some of you really enjoyed the topic, and others are a little bit less enthusiastic, but that's okay. Something that I did want to say, and I hope you know this about me, is that I love Jesus, and I love his church, and I love our church body at Nashville Road. And the reason for this series was never meant to chastise or to guilt people into seeing love as something that you're not doing well enough. You know, that would be like looking at love through the religious model, you know, thinking that somehow you got to love better and then God will love you better. And that's not the case at all. And it would be a failure on my part if you went away each week feeling guilty because you're not loving enough. That was not my intent, but rather it was to help us consider this amazing, overwhelming, beautiful and faithful love of God, and to free us from the religious model version of Christianity that says, you know, we got to perform, we got to do, and free us to experience God's love and his grace through Jesus to love others. And as we said in kind of the first week, I can understand why people push back against Christianity. I get why people push back on Jesus. The thing I want to remove, and it's my heart as a pastor, the thing I want to remove is people resisting Jesus and the church for reasons the church should resist too. I mean, if you want to resist Jesus or Christianity, there should really be only one good reason, and that's that you don't believe Jesus is the Son of God. And that's a valid point, and we can talk about that. But for so many, our negative experiences with church are not about Jesus, but are connected to things that are not central to Jesus or the church. They're connected to religion or the religious version of Christianity, which is an unnecessary and unhealthy blend of the religious model and, you know, the Jesus movement. And we said in week one, as Christians individually and as a body, we hold on to things that were meant to be let go of. And those are the things that hold us back. And when Jesus showed up, he began something revolutionary in how humanity relates to God, which was a total departure from ancient religion and definitely a stark contrast from what is called religion today. And we've been talking about the religious model that represents, you know, everything from ancient religion like Babylon and Egypt and much of religion today. And in that, the religious model, there's always sacred buildings, sacred writings that are interpreted mostly by sacred men for sincere or superstitious followers to tell them how to live and relate to God. And if that sounds oddly familiar, and it sounds like the church maybe you're used to, I hope it doesn't sound like Nashville Road Community Church. I know it doesn't to me. But that's another reason, though, why we're doing this series here at Nashville Road, is to remind us of our mission. And when Jesus showed up, he came to introduce not something just for the Jewish people, but to introduce something for the entire world that is completely revolutionary. What he introduced was a new arrangement between God and humanity for their relationship. And it's not built or dependent on human performance, but on Jesus' work. The ancient Jewish religious model required the sacrifice of an animal to make your relationship right with God. It required the shedding of blood. Something had to die. But because of Jesus, all the blood that needs to be shed has already been shed. And Jesus said, I'm giving a new command, and it will be the one command that goes before all the other ones. And when you're wondering what to do, refer back to this one command, because my one command is to love others like I have loved you. And that will be the ethic for how you live your lives. This ethic will be the filter through which you make every single decision, asking this new question, what does love require of me? And it will be way simpler than the religion that you experienced in the past. Not easier, but simpler. And he began this new movement that has been called the church. But the word he used was unfortunately poorly translated into English. The word ecclesia that was translated as church in our New Testament should have been translated as assembly or gathering. Instead, the word church was used, and it comes from the German word that means house of the Lord. But Jesus didn't come to establish another sacred place. Rather, he came to establish a people. Jesus gathered people around a very simple idea and a very personal claim, and the church was born. And the way of Jesus is far less complicated. There's far less to remember, but as we said last week, it is far more demanding. It's far more demanding because in the religious approach to Christianity, there's always a place to hide. Every religious system has loopholes and workarounds. But it's almost impossible to hide from what Jesus said to his friends. You must love one another as I have loved you. The revolutionary way of Jesus is others-oriented. What Jesus said was so clear that the Apostle Paul followed up years later. And he was an Old Testament scholar. He studied the Old Testament, and what he said was this single command of Jesus is the one thing that is supposed to serve as the filter for everything else. The Old Testament and the New Testament are commentary and application of this one idea. What does love require of me? And the early church, people of the way, that's what they were called, Christians, didn't have the printed Old Testament or the New Testament. They just had this one overarching idea that we are to do for others what Jesus did for us. And the first century Christians did that, and they were known for that. And it was astonishing to those who didn't follow Jesus that these Christians loved them as much as one another. And the idea of loving someone who couldn't do anything for you in return, you know, people just had zero frame of reference for that kind of love. And I believe that the church, the way Jesus intended us to be, is powerful when it is fulfilling Jesus' single command to love, and when we filter every relationship and every action through Jesus' filter of love one another. It's simple but demanding, and it makes the gospel, the good news of Jesus, almost irresistible. And so today, as we wrap up, I just want to take a couple of ideas or words that have been confused or diluted within the religious model approach to Christianity. And these are not new concepts, but we hold on to what is holding us back. And I think if we begin to renew our minds and our consciences to what Jesus taught around these ideas and apply his ethic that says, I know how to treat you like God through Jesus treated me, it will change how we see others and treat others. All right, so we're going to look at a couple of different concepts, a couple of different words. First word is structure, all right? And the church is a body, not an organization. It's not a kingdom. When Jesus was on trial before Pilate, he was asked about this, and Jesus replied that his kingdom was not of this world, not like present earthly kingdoms. Later, the Apostle Paul taught about the kingdom of God, but everywhere he went, he planted churches, and he said to those churches, you're not a kingdom, you're a body, you're representatives of King Jesus, so work together to represent Jesus, and he used the word ambassadors. He said in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 27, he said, you are the body of Christ, and each one of you is a part of it. That's so important. What he was saying is that each of us has been gifted by God to play a role in the church body, which means if you're not engaged, the body is missing something. And if you're not engaged, you are missing something. In the religious model, the experience of gathering is about consuming, right? So that God will be happy with you. The Jesus movement isn't about consuming because the way of Jesus isn't about you. It's about others. It's about engaging with others because we're part of a body of Jesus. The religious model left us with this thinking that, you know, I or me, an individual, can follow in the way of Jesus isolated or separated from the other followers of Jesus. But Jesus invites us to love one another by engaging with one another and help love our community and the world. And if you're disconnected to the body, a disconnected part of the body is like a severed body part. And if I showed you a picture of a severed body part on screen, you know what that would be? It would be gross. So don't be gross. But can you imagine what would happen if we just engaged with one another as a body? Jesus began a movement of people, not a gathering at a place. And here's one easy and I think practical step that we can all take to help sort of change our mindset towards understanding the identity that Jesus had about the church or about us as a movement of people. It's to work on not saying these words, "I'm going to church," or "to the church," but rather say, "I'm going to the church building," or "I'm going to a church gathering," because the people are the church, not the place. All right, so that's structure. Number two is the word authority. And it's the second idea that Jesus redefined for us. It's the word authority. And we talked about a little about this in the first week. In the Jesus way, authority or leadership is supposed to be exercised for the benefit of those being led, not for the leaders. In fact, Jesus turned the leadership paradigm completely upside down, and not just for church leaders, for everyone who follows Jesus. One day, Jesus and his friends they're on their way to Jerusalem and, you know, nearing the time that Jesus would be crucified. And he hears some of his disciples arguing about their potential positions in the kingdom and about who will be on either side of Jesus, the king, who would sit on either side of Jesus, the king. And they figured, you know, that they were going to Jerusalem for a coronation of Jesus, taking the throne. And the truth is, the closer that you are to the king, the better off you are. Right? You eat, you sleep, and you live better. And so they're arguing about that. And Jesus says, okay, you know what, everybody grab a seat. And so he sits them down under, you know, probably under a tree. And he says this, and it's recorded in Matthew chapter 20. He says, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them." Now, if you were one of his disciples, this is probably what they were thinking. Well, yeah, that's how it goes. That's the benefit of authority, so that you can tell other people what to do. You know, they work for you. We know how authority works. And so they're probably saying, you know, what's your point, Jesus? The person who's leading is above the person who's led. It's why you want to get to the top of the pyramid so somebody else can get you coffee. You know, that's why we're trying to figure out what positions we'll have in your new kingdom. And Jesus said this, and catch this. He says, "Not so with you. Not so with you. Not in my movement. That's not how it works anymore. You don't leverage your position or your authority for your benefit." He goes on to say, "Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant." And that word servant actually means courier, right? And in case that doesn't give, you know, them the best picture, Jesus uses a stronger word for their day. He says, "And whoever wants to be first must be your slave." So if you want to be a leader, you got to learn to serve. He goes on to say, "Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." In other words, if you want to be great by Jesus' definition of greatness, serve those around you. And just in case they missed it, when they got to the night before the crucifixion, Jesus took his robe off and he used it to wash their feet, which was an incredibly awkward moment. And right after that, he said, "I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. Truly, I tell you, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him." And so, the application is this: if at whatever point in your life as a Christian, you're given a position with some kind of authority, it just means you are responsible for washing more feet. Wherever you are in your life, not just in the church, any kind of leadership authority, your responsibility as a Jesus follower and your opportunity as a Jesus follower is to figure out how to leverage what you have for your employees' benefit and not the other way around. I love it that someone put it this way. He said, "As a follower of Jesus with any kind of leadership responsibility, we are there to absorb more pain than we inflict." We're there to absorb more pain than we inflict. And what if we got that right? I'll tell you something. People would be lining up to work for a Christian, right? People might say, I don't believe in Jesus, but my boss, you know, she is unbelievably kind and gracious to her staff, and I know she has my best interests in mind. right? At some point, maybe they ask you the question. You know, your employees might ask you the question if you're a position, if you have a leadership position. Why are you this way? Why do you act this way? Maybe you get a chance to answer, well, because I follow Jesus and I'm doing for others what he did for me. I believe God sent his son for my benefit. And I'm asked to do the same for others. That's why I lead the way I do at our company or our division or our department. I recognize it isn't about me. It's about you. Here's another word that Jesus redefined. It's the word spirituality. And I hear that a lot. You know, I was at a wedding last weekend and I was sitting next to someone and he said to me, you know, I just want to let you know, I know you're a pastor, but I'm not religious. I consider myself spiritual. And I understand what he meant. He was saying, I'm not into that religious model, right? But I don't know anything else. And so I'm just not going to be tied into anything. I think spirituality is actually part of our image of godness. You know, it's the way God wired us up. And it's a great word for people on a journey to discover, right? Rather than a plateau or even a destination where we don't grow to more fully understand our relationship with God who created us. Jesus redefined the idea of spirituality. And it is actually about implementation, not destination. It's about implementation rather than destination. In the way of Jesus, spirituality is about how well one loves, not how much one knows. And this is all over the New Testament. In fact, the Apostle Paul taught about the fruit of the Spirit, which is the fruit or the effect in our lives that comes from the indwelling Spirit of God in the followers of Jesus. So if a person is spiritual, here's what you'll see. The fruit of the Spirit is this what you'll see? Let me ask you this. If a person is spiritual, will you see the fruit of the Spirit being insight and knowledge and understanding of the deeper things of faith and the ability to make people listen to you, right? No, that's not what Paul said. He said, but we're prone to think that the more insight someone has, then the more spiritual they are. And that's not true. No, that's not true at all. She's insightful because she reads and she studies and she listens. Right? Or you might have heard someone say, oh, you know, he's so spiritual when he talks, it's just so... No, that's not spirituality. That's preparation and study. And spirituality isn't even limited to having access to a Bible. The early followers of Jesus in the church started with no Bible. Spirituality is about how well one loves. And a spiritual person emanates these fruit: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. And those are found in the book of Galatians chapter 5. You know what? The truth is you don't even have to be able to read for God to be able to live through you. And the cool thing about those characteristics, these fruit, they're all horizontal. They're not vertical, right? These aren't, I'm spiritual this way, you know, kind of up and down in terms of my relationship with God, pointing upwards. It's I'm spiritual this way, outwards, horizontal, external, things people can see and experience, right? And they are also sacrificial, and they're also cross-cultural. They translate regardless of what language you may speak. Here's the other thing. They're also unnatural. They're unnatural because the Jesus model is far simpler but far more demanding than the religious model. So here's my encouragement. Don't be fooled by somebody who knows a lot but doesn't love a lot. That's the religious model, not the Jesus movement. The way of Jesus isn't exemplified by charisma, thank goodness. It's exemplified by the Spirit's fruit, which means the most spiritual person may also be the quietest person you know. It may be the person who knows the least about the Bible but somehow has captured exactly what Jesus meant by doing for others what he has done for them. And finally, the last term that Jesus redefined that we need to think about moving forward with and leaving behind some of what has held us back is this term holiness. Holiness in the Jesus way is about being a part of rather than setting ourselves apart from. And that is huge because the Jesus movement is not about withdrawing from, but engaging with. It's not about disengaging from the world and retreating into a Christian bubble so you don't get the world's cooties. right? It's not about recreating a Christian version of everything, right? Like Christian theme parks, Christian aerobics classes, Christian, you know, cereal or soap or whatever it may be, you know, it's not. It's about engaging with and not disengaging from. In the religious model, maybe even especially in the Christian version of the religious model, sacred is equated with separate. But in the Jesus way, sacred is equated with engagement. And here's why I think we get confused on this. The Old Testament, the Old Covenant, was about a nation, Israel, that God had called to be apart from all the surrounding nations. He said, don't eat like those nations. Don't dress like them. Don't interact with each other like them. Don't marry them. Don't raise your kids like them. And if any of their stuff becomes part of your culture, get rid of it. You are to be set apart from holy. You've got to stay ceremonially clean. And Israel, though, birthed the Messiah. And Jesus, the Messiah, came onto the scene and said, it's a new day. The new has come. We're not here to be separate from, but to be part of and to engage with the people around us. And perhaps really the best illustration of this is when years later, John is reflecting back on Jesus' life and he's writing his eyewitness biography of Jesus. And I mean, I don't even know how you'd even start writing something like that, but here's how he begins. He says, in John chapter 1, verse 14, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. What? I mean, God became one of us, not separate, but among us as one of us. And when Jesus showed up, he freaks everyone out because he kept touching what had been considered unholy things and what were considered unholy people because, you know, they had diseases, but he touched them and he healed them. And all the sacred men, the religious men, they stood back and said, how could Jesus be from God? How can he be holy and be so engaged with unholy people? Well, the answer was because Jesus was doing something revolutionary. And instead of becoming contaminated by their germs, power went out from him and those people were healed. And as a Jesus follower, as Jesus followers, that's what we've been called to do, to engage. The Old Testament message to Israel of disengagement has been overwhelmed by the presence of the Messiah, by the presence of Jesus. So we should not be surprised at the end of his time on earth when he gathers his disciples and they think he's going to establish his kingdom now, right, and retake Jerusalem. And Jesus says, no, you're still thinking religious model. This is something revolutionary. And he says, here's what I want you to do. And Matthew writes it down in Matthew chapter 28, verses 19 and 20. Jesus says, I want you to go spread this good news. And, you know, the disciples ask, well, where are we going? And Jesus says, I want you to make disciples of all nations, all ethnic groups, everyone, everywhere. And you can imagine the disciples who've been used to kind of staying within their own group are like, yeah, but that's going to be scary. They're not like us. They don't behave like us or live like us at all. They don't even believe in the same God as us. So, you know, wouldn't it be just easier if we just stay here and build a kingdom? And Jesus says, no, that day is over. If you're a follower of me, go. And here's my promise. I will be with you always to the very end. When you go, and I know it's different and I know it scares you, but I will be with you because the holy of all holiness indwells you now. And when Luke did his research to write his book, here's what he wrote. Luke says that when Jesus died, the curtain in the temple, right, that separates the Holy of Holies, where God's Spirit dwelt, the epicenter of holiness, that curtain was ripped from the top to the bottom as evidence and symbolic that God had left the building. And you can read about that in Luke chapter 23. God was inhabiting these portable temples, us. And just like Jesus, we are to go and represent him wherever we are. Holiness, then, is no longer about separation, you know, or set apart from. Holiness is about becoming a part of for the sake of other people. So in the Jesus movement, holy people, they get messy. They have messy hands. Messy is the new holy, which means the holiest people in the church body today are those of all ages who are often not visible, but are serving others by sacrificing time and talent and their treasure to live out Jesus' love in practical ways. And I know that Nashville Road Community Church is full of holy people who are engaging and loving. So please, it's so easy to associate visibility or giftedness with holiness, but that's the religious model. The holiest man in history became flesh and died on a cross covered in filth. So imagine if we got this right. If we decided no more just showing up to a church gathering, but living out the love of Jesus as the church in our homes, in our schools, in our workplaces, and in our neighborhoods. And what if we left behind the things that Jesus said he had finished? If all those who have any kind of authority at all decided, you know, I'm going to leverage my position to serve others for the sake of the people God has called and given me the chance to lead. What if we laid down our religious objections to people who make us feel uncomfortable or who we have in the past maybe considered sinners, and we put down our labels or our accusations, and to the best of our abilities through God's grace, we learn to treat them the way that God through Jesus has treated me, has treated us with his love? What if we began to ask at every turn or opportunity or whenever conflict or selfishness rises up in us, we ask the question, what does Jesus' love require of me? What does Jesus' love require of us? What does loving exactly like Jesus' love require of me? Not how far can I go or what can I rationalize from the Bible that gives me a loophole and keeps me comfortable? What if we decided that it was about this one command of Jesus and everything else is just commentary? What if we just decided going forward as we follow Jesus and we keep our focus on him as the beginning and the end of our faith and to keep our focus on loving like he does? That's the revolutionary way that Jesus began, and that changes the world. That's the only should that Christians need to keep in focus, loving others with the same love that Jesus loved us. And doing that will set the church back 2,000 years, but it will move us forward.